On the campus of KU in Lawrence, if you're lucky, you can get a sneak peek at the ornithology department's specimen collections. Ornithology is a word for the study of birds, and the collection is a huge library of cabinets filled with, what else? Birds. 113,000 birds, once living, now preserved. They're lined up in flat files, positioned identically, stored with legs crossed to maximize cabinet space, which makes them look like a chorus line posing in perfect unison. They've got labels tied to their little bird legs documenting crucial information like when and where they were collected, and their colors are so vibrant it's hard to believe they're not alive. Ruby reds and emerald greens. This is where Town Peterson heads to work, day in and day out. He's the curator of collections for KU's Natural History Museum, and he has personally brought back a number of these birds from exotic places around the globe. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're going to hear about Town Peterson's latest discoveries. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Gina.
The big news is that after years and years of studying birds in Mexico, you have documented how climate change is affecting species living there. What exactly have you observed?
Well, what we were able to do was to put together new data and old data. So essentially new data that were reported and accumulated and reported by bird observers across Mexico, but also old data in the form of data taken from those same museum specimens you just mentioned.
So data is like these objects that are sitting there documenting moments in the evolution of this species.
Yeah, the data are associated with those objects. So you have the bird, which is a skin and feathers and some bones. But as you said, there's a label tied to the feet, and that label says who, which is to say, what is the species? Where in Mexico, where in the world was this bird collected, and when? And other ancillary data that are perhaps less relevant to what we've done recently.
So talk to me about what you have done recently.
Well, we put together two sets of data, one documenting bird distributions in Mexico approximately up to the middle 20th century, so up to the 1950s. And that's a very comprehensive study that I've been working on for about 25 years now with two colleagues in Mexico. Should be published by now. It isn't. But essentially what it is it's an atlas of the distributions of each of more than 1,000 species of birds in Mexico. So we put that together with these new data that come, let's say, from 2000 to present, which document known occurrences of each of those same 1,000 plus species of birds across the country. And essentially what we did was we compared the two and we found where are species being lost and where are species being gained across Mexico.
When you say lost and gained, does that mean that the species either cease to exist or come into existence, or does it mean they've migrated or changed?
Well, movement is possible, but almost certainly what we're talking about is genuine loss, where populations disappear. But we're not talking about extinctions of species. We're talking about across the range of a species, the populations in a particular region disappearing.
Okay, so it's that they're not present in Mexico anymore.
No, it's that they're not present in a certain sector of Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Essentially, what we did was we took the whole country and we divided it up into 270-some one-degree blocks, so about 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers, 55 miles on a side. And we tallied the occurrence, old and new, of each species in each of those blocks. Now, we had to do a little bit of playing to figure out which blocks had been surveyed well enough in the recent data that we could make those comparisons.
And so talk to me about a specific species where you've seen some of this loss and tell me how this is playing out for that species.
Well, there's a jay, a lot like our blue jay here in Kansas, here in Missouri, which is very dramatic. It's kind of blackish blue and white, very beautiful jay, and it's found only in cloud forests. So this is forests up in the mountains, very humid, on either coast of Mexico. And this jay is known basically from three mountains along the west coast of Mexico, so from Acapulco south, basically. And it's known from, again, just these three little pockets of cloud forest. And it's a species that was described more than 100 years ago. But two of the three populations were documented and then really haven't been found since. And so you go from three mountains where this species is found down to one where it can still be seen. And that, of course, makes it quite a bit more vulnerable to extinction and such.
How have you made the connection between this loss and climate change?
Well, it's all correlational, which is to say, if I were in a court of law and somebody were to say, have you proven that climate change is responsible for the loss of these species? The answer is no, because scientists don't prove things. What we do is we seek associations, we propose hypotheses, and we test them. And so what we did was we assembled these two sets of data, which are pretty unique, and very unique is having them together in the same place. We detected the change, which is to say we spotted those regions where each individual species apparently no longer has populations. And then we looked at the pattern of those changes as it relates to several different features of Mexican geography. So, for example, one thing we looked at was an index of human impact. And it's a data product that's out there that talks about proximity to cities and proximity to roads and human populations. And so essentially that gave us one dimension, which was the human dimension. We had another dimension, which was actual observed changes in climate. And we divided that into precipitation, rainfall, and temperature change. And so we essentially had those three classes of information. And then we looked for correlations or associations, where is, you know, high temperature change associated with more losses of species populations, or is high change in rainfall or high human impact, are those associated with these changes? And the answer was actually pretty surprising. You know, the usual conservation biology answer would be that all of this is acting to change the natural state. And what we found was that really the influence of temperature change was very, very dominant. And so that was very interesting.
More dominant than other geographic changes.
Well, more dominant than precipitation. So that was particularly interesting, because within the same data set, these observed changes in climate over the second half of the 20th century, within the same data set, what we saw was temperature with a very clear association with losses of populations of species, and precipitation with no significant effect.
So what would you say are the implications, not just for birds, but for life and ecosystems on planet Earth? I mean, do you see an implication here?
Certainly there are implications, and perhaps the implication is nothing new to the world of conservation. If we're designing protected areas networks like our national parks, if we're designing those networks to protect biological diversity, then we really need to revisit the design to make sure that that design is robust to ongoing climate change.
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean there? Because I think of parks as places that are designed more in terms of like pathways to walk through them, stuff like that, but that design would protect species from changing temperatures seems like incomprehensible to me.
Not necessarily that you can protect them from changing temperatures, but rather that you can give them pathways to move and adjust and shift distributionally within natural areas so that those populations don't go extinct.
Can you give an example of a place and a species and how human design could give birds a pathway to survival and movement?
Well, yeah. Imagine if you had a park that is, you know, in a forest at the base of a mountain, and another one that is in a forest without a mountain right next to it. So if temperature's warm, and if temperature influences on species distributions are as strict as they appear to be, then essentially that set of temperatures where the species had been moves up into the higher elevations. In the first park I mentioned, the species has essentially a little bit of cushion because there are higher elevations right there, maybe within the boundaries of the park. In the other park that I mentioned, it's just a low, flat area. The forest may be beautiful, but the new temperature regime may be too warm for the species.
And so what can people do about that?
People, perhaps very little. Except via governments and non-governmental organizations that design these biodiversity conservation strategies. And so when you hear about wilderness areas being expanded or buffer zones being added or new areas being protected, that's oftentimes about making those parks or those reserves more robust and more self-sufficient.
Have you observed in your, you've been going to Mexico and studying bird species there over a long period of time, and other than noticing changes in numbers or occurrence of birds within a species, have you noticed other changes? You have specimens that you've brought back over many years, and I'm curious if they appear different from one another in other ways in this process of diminishing population.
Well, the specimen comparisons, essentially that's an area of active research, which is to say detecting evolutionary change or detecting movements over these time spans. Essentially, that's why this study was published where it was. It's a rather unusual thing to be able to do. But I'll give you an example from earlier work of mine. I was actually in the United States, but my doctoral dissertation focused on another group of jays out in California. And a previous study in the 1940s had gone essentially from one form of this jay to another across about 30 miles along the California-Nevada border. And so I went out to get new specimens of these jays, essentially to be able to replicate that earlier work. And so I started in the coastal form, which is very white and blue, and I was going to essentially move across this transition zone to the ones that are gray and blue. And I kept going and going and going, and I never got to the gray and blue ones. I ran out of time, but essentially what had happened was the zone of transition between these two forms had effectively shifted, it looks like maybe 40, 50 miles to the east. And so we do pick up these changes by doing detailed studies.
And by returning to the same place over and over again, it sounds like, how long have you been going on bird research expeditions to Mexico?
Well, first time I went to Mexico was in 1988. Went back by the end of 1988 and stayed for 6 months, essentially doing nonstop field work. And I've been going back periodically since then.
Explain what happens on an expedition like this. A lot of people are familiar with the hobby of birding, you know, like looking up at the sky with binoculars and listening for certain bird calls. Is that part of what you do?
Certainly. So the expedition begins without even having left the office or the laboratory. We have a lot of planning where picking the right place is crucial. So what we're looking for usually is native primary habitat, you know, well-preserved forest or well-preserved savanna or whatever it is we're interested in. I work with maps. Believe it or not, we do a lot of work with Google Earth. It's a very, very useful tool. And so we pick out as best as we can a place. We make the logistic arrangements, which in Mexico is quite easy because I have wonderful colleagues there who are usually out in the field much more than I am. And so they're also helping to set up all of the work that's to be done. And then you have this massive logistic mess, which is transporting all sorts of equipment either to Mexico or from Mexico City out to the field site. Sometimes it's...
Where is the field site?
It can be anywhere in the country. In that first trip in 88-89, we worked in 26 of the 31 states. So, you know, we can be going by pickup trucks, by bus. One time we paid a train engineer to stop halfway between two stations in an uninhabited valley where there were no roads, so the only way we could go in was by train.
Wow. When you get there, when you get to these remote locations with all of the equipment that you've painstakingly gotten to these remote locations, what is it exactly that you're doing?
Well, essentially our job on these trips is to put together a very thorough documentation of what species of birds are there. And there may be colleagues along who are looking at reptiles and amphibians and mammals or what have you. So in the bird world, what we do is we combine observational work with specimen collecting. So the observational work will be using your best birding abilities to go out and detect each species that's present in the area. And that's very important because sometimes we can't accumulate specimens of every species of bird that's present.
A big part of this does have to do with the collections I described a little while ago, the ornithology collection over at the KU Natural History Museum. So explain to me how, you know, when you are going to bring back specimens and you talked about collecting specimens, what exactly does that entail? Because, you know, we have skipped that step. You have to get these birds from like jungles and places like that back to KU in Lawrence. You have to do something to preserve them for the journey, right?
Okay, so there is the uncomfortable step of you have to capture the bird and euthanize it, something that nobody likes doing. But if you are focused on populations of birds, then yes, it's the loss of a life, but no, it is not a danger to the population in any sense. Once the bird is euthanized, then it can be prepared as a specimen. And so essentially what you can imagine is taking out all the meat and all the guts, brains, etc., and replacing all of that with cotton. And the skin is then dried, and obviously we have to protect it against insects and such. But once those collections are stabilized, usually in the field, then back out to the capital, to Mexico City, and then there's a whole set of steps which are logistic and permitting and essentially to be able to bring biological materials into the U.S. There are a whole series of permits that need to be secured. So we do that very carefully. And then once they come back to KU, essentially what we're doing is we're finishing the preparation and curation. So we have to make sure the specimen is completely dry. We have to prepare skeletal specimens, prepare anatomical specimens. We have laboratories and we have staff who are specialized in that. It's part of my job. And then a very important step is to digitize the data associated with the specimen. So essentially making possible the sort of studies that I've been talking with you about.
So you're out in a remote area and you have to do this highly technical stuff. Have you ever had to do that in sort of unlikely environments?
My kids remember driving across Texas and my finding a dead crow by the side of the road. And I didn't have my dissecting kit and I didn't have any supplies. And so I was stealing sand out of the cigarette ashtray in the hotel where we stayed to be able to soak up fluids as I was preparing the specimens. So, yeah, there's a lot of improvisation.
You can make do, it sounds like.
Yeah, ideally we're in a camp that has a nice work tent and all of our equipment. And ideal never happens. You know, it's always raining or, you know, my last expedition, which was in Africa, bees were so prevalent that you couldn't sit back without running the risk of being stung. It was so hot that you really didn't want to be in the tent. And so, yeah, it's all improvised because the conditions can be very uncomfortable.
A career in ornithology is not something like when you are a kid and you get a book like, what are you going to be when you grow up? And there's like the firefighter and the postman and the doctor and the teacher and stuff like that. Ornithologist isn't in there. And I'm curious about what it was that made this occur to you as a career path and inspired you.
I have an older sister who was interested in birds. I probably got the original impetus through her. And then there were two very, very meaningful mentors at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, who, when I was as young as five, were giving me opportunities and opening doors for me.
So you were just obsessed with birds from the beginning?
Some might say that, yes.
What interests you about them? I mean, obviously you have a professorial level of knowledge to be able to answer that question now, but the interest goes back before you had that.
I put a lot of value on knowledge for knowledge's sake. And the wonderful thing about academia is that you're given the freedom to pursue those interests. Birds are fascinating. They're beautiful. They're diverse. They're distributed across world geography. So at the same time you're learning about biology, you're learning about geography, 100 different reasons.
You've been doing your field work on species of birds in Mexico and what is it about Mexico that made this a good place to be going for this?
Mexico is a meeting of two biological worlds, North America and the temperate zone, and South America, Central America, and the tropical zone. So Mexico certainly ranks very high in terms of bird diversity worldwide. So that was certainly something that was part of the equation. But also just, I have wonderful colleagues in Mexico, and they've made me welcome literally since I got off the plane the first time, arriving in 1988. And those have turned into lifelong friendships. And so, yeah, it's just there are lots of reasons to keep going back to Mexico.
Do you think that you're finding that there are species of birds that have been experiencing losses in certain parts of Mexico and that's connected with rising temperatures? Do you think that says something about how climate change might be affecting other species in other parts of the world, or is that too much conjecture?
Certainly, which is to say, we know that species respond rather closely, rather strictly to the conditions where they are present. We know that temperature is a very important determinant of populations of species, behavior of species, reproductive ability. And so without a doubt, now this result that we got where temperature dominates precipitation, not necessarily is going to be general. The thing is, this is one of the first studies where those comparisons have been possible. So we put this out in the literature in some senses, as a challenge to ourselves and to our colleagues to replicate this study elsewhere and for other taxa.
Why hasn't it been possible in other places?
Putting together the old and the new data is the challenge. We were kind of ready for this study because back as far as 1990, My Mexican colleagues and I have been preparing this Atlas of Mexican Bird Distributions. And so as the new data came along, we were already with the old data. Mexico isn't the only place, and birds aren't the only taxon where you could do this work. But putting those data together and quality controlling them, and you know, it's literally been a 20-year process.
What is next in the process? I mean, where do you go from here?
Actually, in just a few days, I'll be leaving for Mexico for a month. And the plan for the project is to go through all records of birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, and fishes, so all vertebrates that have been accumulated and associated with specimens, so all the historical data, and pick out individual sites across the country that have been surveyed exhaustively, completely, let's say, you know, before 1980. And so what we're planning to do is develop essentially a database of well-known sites. So the work that we've been talking about today has been essentially across the whole country and a well-known...
Of Mexico.
Of Mexico. But at the level of 1 degree blocks. Remember I said that 100 kilometers on a side.
Yeah.
So now what we want to do is take it down to individual sites and challenge, again, ourselves, our students, our colleagues, to go back to those same sites and replicate the studies exactly 50 years later, 100 years later.
So that's quite a commitment into the future.
I didn't say I'd go do them all.
You're not going to do that 50 years from now?
I'd love to be able to. No, what this is essentially organizing the data so that when people are interested in developing studies, they have a guide of which places would be particularly fruitful, because not only do you get the new information, but you get the comparison with the old information.
Townsend Peterson, curator of collections at KU's Natural History Museum, thanks for taking the time to talk with us about the connection between climate change and bird life in Mexico.
My pleasure.